Welcome to episode 246 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today, we're going to be looking at how to make your dreams come true and to find a ski job in the Alps. We're going to be looking at what jobs are available, what skills you need, when to apply, and how the market has changed in the last few years. We're also going to look at the ski instructor qualifications available, where they entitle you to work. Finally, we're going to find out more about the possible youth mobility scheme. Now, with the season now drawing to a close, there might only be a few resorts open, but we still have some snow reports for you. Plus, I'm going to be giving some more details about the new UK Snow Challenge I'm attempting next month. Now, my name is Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest today. Joining me for her second time on the show, I'm delighted to welcome Jenny Greenwood, HR Director at Ski World. Is that your job title, Jenny?
Yeah, I'm head of HR, and I've been with them now for 18 years, so got a wealth of experience in the ski industry.
Excellent. Well, that's why we invited you onto the show. And where are you today?
I'm actually in Twickenham. I'm just a short walk from the stadium for any of you rugby fans.
My second guest, actually on the podcast for the first time, I'm delighted to welcome George Gray, co-founder of the ski job recruitment specialist Season. Hi, George. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. Really excited to be here. Yeah. Former season there, and set up this new company only a year old now. And yeah, really excited.
Cool. And whereabouts are you today, George?
So currently I'm based in Leger.
Right. Okay. And if you look out the window now, is there any snow around still in Leger, or are you in full spring mode now?
I'm seeing a beautiful spring right now. It's a nice change to the snow, but yeah, season's well and truly over here.
Well, you know, I love the mountains at any time, regardless of whether it's winter or not. Someone else who I think is in the mountains today, it's a real pleasure to welcome back Dave Burrows from Snow Pros Ski School in Switzerland. Dave is a regular contributor to the show. Listeners will know his unique snow reports he delivers from around the Alps. He joins us today with his ski instructor hat on to discuss the different types of instructor qualifications. Hi, Dave. How are you going?
I'm doing great, Ian. How are you? And thanks for having me on. Hello, everybody who's listening.
Cool. Whereabouts are you, Dave?
I live in Valdilier, which is on the Swiss side of the Port du Soleil.
Cool. And would I be right in saying that all of your instruction, all of your lessons have finished for this season now? Or do you keep going in any of those kind of resorts that are still open?
We had some stuff still going on in Verbier until about I think it was the last one was about 20th of April, but for me personally, yeah, it was second week of April.
Okay, well, I know that you do enjoy a few turns in the summer from time to time, and a question I always like to ask our guests is, when did you ski or snowboard last? So let's start with you, Dave. When was that for you?
My last session was finishing off a level one ski instructor qualification. That was on, not for me, but for some people who were taking it. And that was on April the 12th in Le Creuset. And so finished off that course and I headed up the lift on my own and just did one last run on the Stad in Le Creuset just for myself and then called it a day.
Really positive way to finish the season off. What about yourself, Jenny? When were you last on snow?
Unfortunately, due to life events this season, I haven't been able to get onto the snow at all. So last year was my last time on the mountain. And it was actually in the plan. It's our end of season trip that we do for all of our London staff go out overseas. And the ones that went out this year, it was in teen, and they are still talking about it. They are still talking about the stories, and they went just as they had in mid-April when we just had that last dump of snow, and they arrived the day after. So they had perfect conditions, and we've had that for the last two seasons. Just fantastic.
Sure, although if they'd, evidently they timed that really well to arrive just after that heavy snow had fallen and at a very high resort, because Floss Cockle, who reported for us in the last podcast, also reported that Jean had problems with power cuts and things like that, you know, during that heavy snow. So better to arrive after it's finished rather than to be there while it was going on. But that's brilliant timing. What about yourself, George? Was it somewhere in the Port du Soleil as well?
I was actually skiing in Andorra at last, just sort of mid-April, actually. My first time being there was beautiful. It was quite different terrain to the Alps. You know, the trees grow a lot higher out there. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. Quite different.
Oh, what resort were you at? I've also not skied in Andorra.
So we were staying in Tarta and we were skiing in Sordeu, operated by Gran Valira. And yeah, it was, I was really surprised about how great the skiing was even that late in the year.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. Well, I mentioned there is still some skiing on. Both Ladies Alp and Dean are currently open, as is Val Thorens and some of the Austrian glaciers, Zermatt, etc. But we do have a couple of snow reports from Alex Elmond from Tip Top Ski Coaching in Ladies Alp and Floss Cockle from Free Flow Floss YouTube channel in Teen. So let's have a listen to those.
Hi, this is Alex from Tip Top Ski Coaching here in Ladies Alp, giving you an update of our snow conditions. Well, amazingly, we're due more snow again next week, having had loads of snow over the last few weeks. Snow conditions are looking absolutely amazing. We move to springtime opening from the 5th of May. That will mean that we can ski from 3,600 metres to 2,600 metres for the whole of May. And then in June, we'll move to springtime skiing again, but June springtime skiing. And it will be just glacier skiing. So that's 3,600 metres to 3,200 metres with the signal lift as well, should snow conditions allow. And for the time being, we're expecting snow over the weekend. We're expecting snow next week. So things are looking good. And we are hoping and expecting to have a wonderful spring ski season. We look forward to seeing you up on the glacier.
Hi, this is Floss from Free Flow Ski, reporting to you the last weather report for Teen and Valizère in the French Alps for this winter 24-25. Now, after the storm of the season a few weeks ago, with some settling, the snow has been totally gold. It's been amazing. Now, Teen and Valizère is finishing this winter on such a high this Sunday. It has been back-to-back wall of sunshine and spring temperatures. It's almost been too hot, as towns in the valley have reached 27 degrees. Now, the last 5 days for ski touring in the backcountry, it has been epic. The off-piste routes are still in good condition and still open for you to ski on. There are 74% of lifts still open crossing over Teen and Valizère, and you'll find the best quality of snow is in the morning up to 2 p.m. What a week, what a finish. I can't tell you and highly recommend that this week has just been so great. Quiet slopes and great snow. So just wrapping up the winter this year, it's been a strong and plentiful start and a strong and great finish for the season. Just wanting to wish everybody a happy and great summer and speak to you soon.
I mentioned in our last episode on the 30th of May, I'm going to be taking on a special challenge to raise funds for Snow Camp. The 25 for 25 Snow Camp challenge is to ski a minimum of 10 runs at Tamworth Snow Dome, Chill Factory in Manchester, Snow Zone Yorkshire and Castleford, Snow Zone Milton Keynes and Hemel Hempstead, all on the same day. And the reason it's called 25 for 25 is I'm aiming to raise £2,500, and that will give 25 inner city young people the chance to experience snow sports for the first time in 2025. Now, many of our listeners will be familiar with Snow Camp, but just in case, let's hear from Dan Keeley, their community and events director, about the work they do.
Well, thanks, Ian, and hi, everyone. My name is Dan Keeley. I'm the Community and Events Director at Snow Camp. For those that don't know who we are, we're a youth snow sports charity who for the past 21 years have been breaking down barriers and broadening horizons for many of the UK's most underserved or disadvantaged inner city young people across London, the Midlands, the Northwest and Scotland. We harness the power of skiing and snowboarding to develop life skills, qualifications and vocational opportunities and provide positive pathways for these young people that truly need these positive opportunities in life. So in many respects, we use the power of snow sports as a really powerful youth work tool to engage young people in an alternative pathways that leads on to future career opportunities, apprenticeships or going on to further education or other positive destinations. For all the Snow Camp team, we love what we do. It's a privilege for me personally to be part of the core team down in Brighton. But then, as I've mentioned, we do work nationally with an incredible team of programme managers, wellbeing managers and apprentices to inspire and encourage the next wave of young people joining our programs every year. So our three-stage journey delivered at the indoor slopes and the Scotland outdoor slopes as well culminates with a life-changing week in the mountains. So actually at the time of recording, we've got a better part of 100 young people out in Andorra having a life-changing week in the mountains as a celebration of the three-part journey that they've been on with Snow Camp over the past 12 months. And on the back of our 20th anniversary, in 2023, we really feel like we're, you know, embarking on the next two decades of impact at the charity. So to you, Ian, thank you so much for your support. I know you've been with us now for many, many years. And to everybody listening to this, whether you're in the snow sports industry or otherwise, we're just hugely grateful to every single person who just understands the power of the mountains and the power of snow sports to have a hugely positive impact on many young people out there across the UK that just need a leg up in life sometimes. So thank you for joining us on the journey. Thanks again to you, Ian. And yeah, if anybody wants to get in touch, then have a look at our website, snow-camp.org.uk, or just Google us, you'll find us. Thank you so much.
So here's a point, listener. If you like the sound of what Snow Camp do and you'd like to support their work, I would really appreciate it if you would sponsor me. I'm going to put a link to the Just Giving page in the show notes and on Ski Podcast social channels. And if you'd like to click through and make a donation of any size, I would really appreciate it. Right. Let's get on to today's subject, working a season in the Alps. If you're listening to this show, there's a good chance that you've thought about it. You may even have done it already. But the situation has changed a lot since I worked my ski seasons. So I wanted to bring in some experts to tell us how to score that dream job today. So I'd like to start with George, if that's okay. You kind of touched on it in the introduction there. Season, spelled CZN. When did it start and why?
So, yeah, I'll give you a little bit of backstory. So I did a season last year in Morzine, and as I'm sure you can all relate, you know, I had the time of my life. You know, I really enjoyed it. I met some lifelong friends. I loved the company I worked for, skiing all the time, and I really couldn't recommend it more. But the only thing I sort of found frustrating was the process of getting a job. I was in London and I spent about, I think it was like 4 weeks. You know, I was literally Googling chalet company in blank resort. I was navigating to their jobs tab on their website, sending out cold emails only to find out that, you know, they only hired EU passport holders. And there are some outdated job boards, and I was filling out different forms. And when I got out to resort and I was talking to, you know, some of my friends and some other seasonaires, you know, a lot of the frustrations were shared, sort of very similar frustrations. So a few friends and I decided to try our hand at making a more sort of modern job board, but we really approached it from the point of view of the candidates. So allowing people to filter by whether or not the job accepted UK passport holders, for example, whether or not the job offered accommodation, you know, all these kind of things that candidates really care about. And, you know, we launched that July last year and we got really good traction. We were really surprised. We got over 1,000 users, 40 companies using the platform, and, you know, we didn't have any money to spend on advertising. So this really showed us that there was sort of an appetite in the market for this kind of solution. So what we've been doing this winter is we've been working with companies in the industry to really understand, you know, their processes, what their bottlenecks are, and how we can essentially save them time and money and give them access to, you know, a candidate pool of professional seasonaires who really want to take this seriously and sort of know what to expect. We developed a applicant tracking system with all the bells and whistles you might expect from a corporate tracking system. You know, you can manage your applicant all the way through from when they first apply to interviews to when they're signing the contract, all the way through to onboarding them and getting them out into resort. And what we've seen now is that a lot of these problems exist in other similar seasonal businesses all over the world. So whether that be yachting, beach resorts, you know, working a bar in Thailand, even like scuba diving, surfing, you know, there's so many industries around the world where seasonal work underpin them. And a lot of the people doing this kind of work travel around from season to season and they can make a career out of it. You know, some people dip their toe in for like one or two, but you know, people really do make a career out of it. So what we want to do is we want to serve that generation that values travel, experience, and build a platform where they can build a reputation and grow their network so they don't have to start from scratch when they move from skiing to yachting. So yeah, almost like a LinkedIn, but we care more about you know, what languages you speak, if you've done a season, and less about if you've done Excel, that kind of thing.
As someone who once ran a ski recruitment website, which was Natives back in the day, I can kind of relate to all of those things that you're talking about. You know, then, back in 1999, there was definitely a need, and it was the very early days of the internet. These days, the internet is prolific. It's interesting to hear your experience that you're saying you were searching and you weren't able to find the information that you need. But also from that conversation just then, what you were telling us about the season website, we had a jobs board on Natives. It was very easy to search and to filter. But I like what you're talking about there to make it easier for the employer to handle all the applications on the website as well. At the moment, you're just focusing on ski, right? So what kind of jobs are available on there?
You know, we have all kinds of jobs. We have, you know, your more traditional chalet host roles, drivers. But then all the way, you know, last year we had a sign language interpreter in Lapland. So there's all these kind of jobs that you wouldn't think about as sort of typical seasonal jobs. You might not think of doing a season and being a nanny, or you might not think of doing a season and being a massage therapist. You know, there's all these kind of jobs that the industry needs. So we're trying to create a place where they can all exist.
Oh, and I'm interested as well. You know, I agree with all of those things, and people aren't always aware of the options. I think you said you worked a season last year. What job were you doing last winter?
So I was your traditional chalet host. So it was me and my very good friend from university, and we were running a chalet in Morzine. So all the cooking, all the cleaning, all the hosting, all the shopping. Yeah, it was brilliant. And I really enjoyed meeting all the guests and, yeah, got better at cooking as well.
Ooh, well, I definitely think that's the best way to understand the industry if you've been on the inside of it already. And I think a lot of our listeners are always interested in people who start up businesses within the snow sports industry. You know, you said you come out of university. What degree did you do at university? Do you carry any of that into this entrepreneurial spirit that you have?
So I did business economics at Exeter. So I guess I learned some transferable skills.
We'll come back to you again, George, in due course. That sounds really interesting. And I'll put links to all of the different websites in the show notes. I'm going to turn to Jenny now, if I can, because, you know, we're lucky enough to have one of those employers that George was referring to with us today. And I did check this beforehand. I think I'm right in saying, Jenny, that Ski World is the UK's largest chalet company, or the largest recruiter of staff for chalets. Is that right?
Yes, we are. I mean, there are other companies, as George mentioned, that do nannies and things like that. But obviously, from the chalet product as such, delivering the service to the customers, yeah, we are.
And how many staff do you employ then in total?
We have had 195 over the season, but then obviously we're growing and we're just working on our programme for next year. So we're still looking at that.
Oh, well, I love that fact that you're growing, because I think, you know, you mentioned that you've been working for Ski World for 18 years now. During 18 years, you've seen a huge number of changes in that time, of which the most significant would have been Brexit, I suspect, but also the impact of COVID as well, and the pandemic. During that period, I guess from 2020 to 2016, even from to maybe a couple of years ago, the number of staff that you're recruiting has presumably decreased quite a bit.
Yes, as in most businesses, navigating Brexit was a challenge. Costs increased, food, transport, and the cost of the holidays increased to compensate for that, which unfortunately some tour operators couldn't survive. Therefore, the actual number of chalet holidays decreased. But as we're really lucky, is we are on the increase now, and Brexit did create quite a few challenges with obviously employment, and therefore we are in the process and have been navigating all the challenges that have come about. But we've navigated them, and we are now in a position whereby we are able to grow and increase our product. And unfortunately, with the competition decreasing, the number of applicants that are coming through, therefore there is obviously a lot of competition for them.
We did do a job special a couple of years ago when you were on the show, and I wanted to do this again because in 2 years, you know, things have changed. Like, as you said, you know, now you're increasing the number of per staff. But I had a listen to that podcast again. And I think at the time you told me that you had 5,000 applications for 170 jobs. So 30 people for every job available. Is it still that same sort of ratio?
Yes, it is. With the number of applicants, everybody still has a fair chance. Everybody has still got their opportunity to put themselves forward, to sell themselves, to really push their experience. So whatever number of applicants there are, we go through them all. We process them all. Anyone who applies to us, we will look at those applicants and sift through them. So just because of the volume doesn't mean to say that they won't necessarily get looked at.
Evidently, you want to make your application as appealing as possible. You need to be able to get over those points. So if someone's listening to this podcast now and they're thinking about applying for a ski job, what sort of elements should they bear in mind to make their application stand out?
Well, as we've mentioned, the number of applicants is increasing. And we also have, because the holiday costs have increasing, customers' expectations are a lot higher. And therefore, customer service is paramount. And the more you can present your skill sets, what you can bring to the company, the better. And actually putting out on your CV, making it really clear, making it so what you can bring, the motivation of why you're wanting to do a season, and where you can add value to the business is really important. You just need to really sell yourself.
I'm just in the process of doing some recruitment for ski instructors at the moment, and I put an advert out through some various channels that we use, and you would not believe how badly presented some of the applications are that we get. And the one killer thing that really works for me would be a really well presented cover letter or email, doesn't contain millions of spelling mistakes and doesn't, you know, is well written. It's not very difficult, I think, in the modern day to do that, but for me, when we're recruiting, that's like the first impression, right? It's the first chance you get to make an impression. And that is, for me, all important.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to hear that. And as you say, you'd think that these days with all the spell checkers and things like that, there wouldn't be any excuse for that. But just turning back to you then, Jenny, obviously every employer has their own process for recruitment. You're saying you look at all of the applications, regardless of how many there are. So what is the process from there? When do you get to the point when you decide who you're going to interview, and how do those interviews happen? Are they face-to-face or are they by video?
We start off, we look at all the applicants, and then what we do from there is the ones we feel can of interest, that we feel that could then fill some of the skill sets we're looking for. We would then, what we call screen, which is basically the first stage of the interview. And we will contact them, and we all usually, it's by telephone, 15 to 20 minute chat, and it's their opportunity to really sell themselves. I completely agree with you, Dave, that the attention to detail on the CV, the amount of CVs we receive that are sent to Ski World, but they've got another tour operator's name that are saying they want to apply. I 100% agree. And that's where, you know, the job is about attention to detail. It's about noticing things, delivering that exceptional customer service. So it's really important that you stand out and make sure you put your criteria of what you can bring and your motivation. So within that screening, that's what we do. And then they then go to the interview process, which is either face-to-face in our office, or it's actually on Teams if they can't get to the office. We like to meet them in person because it's a one-to-one, and it's important that we get to meet them. And they also find out about us. At Ski World, we believe that it's a two-way thing, an interview. They've got to know and understand what they're going to get. And we obviously want to make sure that they're right people for the role.
And George referred to, on the season website, you can filter by jobs as to whether or not you need an EU passport. Now, again, we discussed this a couple of years ago. The sense I had then initially after Brexit, everyone wanted to recruit people with an EU passport. Because of the work that ESPIT, seasonal businesses and travel, have been doing and liaising with the French authorities, there's now a process whereby you don't necessarily need to have an EU passport because you can get a visa. Without perhaps going into all of the details, do you just want to explain how that works? I mean, assuming that I'm correct in that you don't need to have an EU visa to be able to get a job, for example, with Ski World.
Yeah, you don't actually need to have an EU passport. We are very open to employ staff with a UK passport. And yes, we will escort them and support them through the process. There, within the application of the process, there is a lot of work that we do for them. And then there's the elements that they have to do themselves, the applicants. I would say that if it's during the season and they have a EU passport, they probably are a slight advantage because obviously they go through the visa and permit process can take time. But there are tour operators out there that are only employing staff with EU passports. But we're not one of them. Ski World's not one of them.
Because there is a cost involved to the employer to arrange the visas, etc., and an administrative process that takes quite a lot of time.
Yeah, it certainly is. When you apply for your actual visa, you have to go to the embassy, either in London, Manchester or Edinburgh. And that means actually giving over your passport that can be up to 5 weeks. So you need to, through the summer, be in a position whereby you are able to attend those appointments. We can't do that part for you. We can't go to the embassy for them. So they do need to be in a position whereby they can spend the time in doing that. So that's a pretty important element. So if you are traveling throughout the summer, you do need to recognise that there are parts within the visa permit process that you do need to partake in.
That's really interesting. George, I wondered if I could come back to you. We've been talking predominantly, Ski World, obviously a chalet company. We've been talking about chalet jobs predominantly. What about other jobs such as bar jobs or non-cooking roles? And in particular, my experience of running natives when I did is that we tend to get a lot of 18-year-olds who are interested in working seasons and not necessarily many jobs available for 18-year-olds. Do you have any thoughts on those sort of things?
Yeah, I just want to echo what Jenny and Dave said about the industry sort of looking for people who really understand it, they really present themselves well, and that's really why we're trying to help guide these candidates through helping them understand what employers look for, helping them go through the application process, and then also building in things to help them manage that visa process because, you know, as you mentioned, it does cost, I think it's the ESPIT stats were £880 and 3 to 4 days of admin and staff time. So we really want to try and help the company streamline that and then also guide the applicants through that process. It's similar with other sort of types of jobs. You know, Ski World, obviously very established company, and they have the knowledge, expertise and resources to help guide their applicants through. But for some other companies, it might be a little bit more disjointed and a little bit more harder to organize. A lot of companies are just preferring to hire EU passport holders. But then what we've seen is that, and you know, in places like Japan and Canada, I know Japan recently tripled their visa allocation for UK passport holders. So on a positive note, I do think that hopefully we're going to see some legislation change soon where it is going to be easier for UK passport holders to go and work in the EU.
Sorry, I was just going to add, those costs, George, that he's mentioned, they're not all the staff costs. The employer pays and contributes quite a large proportion of that towards that. And that's sort of stuff that's behind the scenes that ESPIT's been promoting. The cost really is that they own the carte de séjour, which is the part that's applied for in France. And that part is usually the part that they would pay for in most companies. And because it's theirs, they own it for 3 years.
Well, actually, George mentioned that there may be some changes down the track. So this seems like a good opportunity to drop in an interview, which was pretty much at the last minute. I did it a couple of days ago. with Charlie Owen from, we've mentioned before, Seasonal Businesses in Travel, ESBIT, and he's been lobbying for a long time in relation to the Youth Mobility Scheme, and there have been some developments on that. So let's have a quick listen to that interview. I'm delighted to be joined by Charlie Owen, who is the founder and MD of ESBIT and of European Pubs. Hi, Charlie, how are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, Ian. Very good to speak to you again.
Yeah, well, the timing is really good. We're obviously doing a podcast about how to find a ski job at the moment. We touched on the idea of a youth mobility scheme. I wondered if you could just explain to us what a youth mobility scheme is. What does that mean to young British people and from other nationalities as well?
Okay, so thanks very much, Charles, to explain this. What it means is that either a British person applying to the scheme to go and work in another country, or somebody from Australia or New Zealand applying to the scheme to come and work in the UK, will get a visa that will allow them to enter the country and stay there for an amount of time. And it will also allow them to work there for an amount of time. So they can live there for the period of visa and work as well.
And we're talking about extending this to the EU. That's a key part of the discussions at the moment.
Exactly. So, and as you'll see, there's quite a few headlines at the moment that there is the potential that there might be an agreement between the UK and the EU to have a youth mobility scheme, which personally is very exciting. Personally, and through ESBIT, I have been campaigning for this for the last 6 years.
So what has changed? Why might that happen now? I don't know if that's an easy question to answer or not.
Well, I'd like to say it's because the amount of pressure that has been brought to bear by organisations such as ESBIT, Best for Britain, who have pushed the benefits of the Youth Mobility Scheme very hard, but also ABTA, the Future Travel Coalition, and you'll have seen recently 60 Labour MPs have been saying rather strongly that this is in everybody's interests. So I think that combined with polling that shows that this is incredibly popular with the whole of the UK. So 2/3 of those polled thought the youth mobility scheme was great. And that's also backed up by actually some of the fiercest supporters of Brexit. So like Steve Baker and even Lord Frost. Realised that they made a bit of a mistake with not having greater mobility. So I think it's just people have realised that no matter what you, one of the reasons you voted for Brexit, one of the reasons was not to limit opportunities for young people.
Maybe we shouldn't discuss in too much detail potential mistakes made around Brexit, but certainly there'll be a lot of people who'd be in favour of it. Certainly myself, I have two 18-year-olds who are keen to go and do a ski season, and it would make it easier for them. But if, let's say, this was announced and agreed, how quickly might it come in? Is there any chance it could affect people who are looking to go out to the Alps this winter?
My honest answer is that I don't know. However, there are quite a few stages to get through before we have a website that UK potential seasonaires can apply to and get a youth mobility visa. And as you know, in the industry, people are already starting to apply for winter jobs out in the French Alps this year. My gut feel is that for this upcoming winter season, then the route that ESBIT has worked very closely with the French authorities to allow UK staff to work both in the winter season, but also in the summer season, campsite jobs and all that kind of stuff, will probably be the route that most staff and companies use. I hope this is confirmed as soon as possible, but there is still quite a few discussions to work out the details and then actually to work out how we implement it as well.
Just tell us, Charlie, what's the date that people need to look out for? Because there's a big UK-EU meeting coming up. When are we likely to see any sort of an announcement about this?
Look for the announcements and the official announcement coming out of that summit between Keir Starmer and Ursula von der Leyen. So I think that will be the first indication whether they have agreed to move forward on a youth mobility scheme and almost certainly the broad outlines of it. But I would then hope to see in there a timetable for when they would continue working out the details and when it would be implemented.
Oh, well, that is very exciting. We're not rejoining Europe yet. You know, don't worry, Lord Frost and everyone else. Brexit is still Brexit, etc. But hopefully it'll make it a lot easier for British people to go and work and do ski seasons again.
One point I would say, and this is why we've had a youth mobility scheme with many countries around the world and areas where we have free trade agreements, and it's an investment in the future. The more you have young people that actually get the experience to live and work in countries that we have free trade agreements with, it means when they actually come back to the UK and they progress through their careers, and they might be working for companies where you are looking to do build partnerships with other countries in those areas. And if you've had the experience of already working in that country and you understand a bit more of the culture, actually it's a lot easier to work together as companies together. That's why we have youth mobility schemes with areas around the world.
Sure. I think we've covered this in previous podcasts, but so many people who are working in the industry or have set up their own businesses have developed that from the experiences that they picked up during their season. So let's hope that this comes off. And Charlie, thanks so much for your time today. And thanks for all of the work that you've put in over the last 6 years in driving and lobbying towards trying to make this youth mobility scheme actually come into action. Thanks again.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Ian.
So that was really interesting to hear that. Hopefully that will make things better. I don't think it's going to be able to, even if there is a youth mobility scheme announced, it's going to apply for this winter season coming up, 25-26. So question for you, George, then. What would you say the timeline is? When should people be applying for jobs for next winter season?
So, I mean, it really depends. Every company has a different timeline. I mean, some companies are hire before the season even ends. Some companies like to have a holiday, start hiring around June, July. So it really depends. I think it's always worth, from a candidate's point of view, you know, doing a research, being aware, seeing what's out there. What we found from our employer partners is they really like people who are organized and early, because it shows that, you know, they're not sort of thinking, oh, what am I going to do last minute this winter? Or I'll do a ski season. They're really taking the time to think about, plan ahead, and yeah, get prepared. So applying early was always going to help. The majority of companies, if you had to put a peak hiring point, it would be sort of that June, July, September, that kind of range. But again, it really does vary from company to company.
I just wanted to say that I just want to give you an employer's perspective, and this is, you know, for ski instructors, but you would not believe how many CVs and resumes I receive in like September, October, November. And it's completely useless to me to receive those at that point. I'm already selling lessons to people. I need to know how many staff I've got in August, right? So I do my recruitment immediately. You know, I know who's coming back and who isn't. As soon as the lift shut, I'm recruiting, and I want my team in place so that I know how much capacity that I have to sell when I come to sell it in August and September onwards.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Jenny, respect to timing?
Yeah, I'm with Dave on this, and we've just been talking to all of our returning staff. We went out to see them and to talk to them about career progression, development, etc. But also, if people want to go to a particular job, particular resort or go to a particular job, the later you leave it, the less chance you've got, because positions are going to get filled very, very quickly. So the sooner you get in, we've opened up our applications for 25-26. They're open, and we had 1,000 pre-registrations who have obviously, we've asked if you'd like to now start to apply. So the interest starts all winter. People want to know about the jobs and start a lot earlier. The quicker you get on it, the quicker you're going to secure your job. And also, I just want to add that if you don't get in earlier in a UK passport holder, getting through the process will inhibit you getting a job. Because if you haven't got your visa and your permit in place prior to start date, you won't be able to start work.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, well, it's been really helpful so far. George, let me ask you another question as well then. So if someone's like thinking about their year, we've already established could be useful to stay in the UK if you need to go through the visa application process. What about going out to resort? When will people go out to resort? Assuming they are lucky enough to be one of the successful ones and get a job, when would that season start for them?
So it depends on the kind of role usually. Some companies like to get roles that need a lot of training. They want to get them out a few weeks before the season starts, but it's usually sort of early December, I'd say, maybe even late November. But again, it does depend. And we're also seeing some companies start to hire for, you know, peak season. So they'll hire just for sort of 3 months of the year and really just have extra staff when they're really busy. But the majority of roles, yeah, sort of that late November, early December. But it does depend on how much training you need.
Okay. And say there's someone listening to this podcast, they're not listening to it when I published it in early May. Maybe they've come on to it, when the season has already started. Can people still apply for jobs during the season once it's underway?
Yeah, so things always happen out in season. You know, there's always people who aren't a good fit or have to drop out for whatever reason. So a lot of companies that we work with do hire, I guess, last minute staff because of things changing. But that's something that we're trying to build into our platform, where you can have a standby list of candidates, of people who are, you know, ready to come out at the drop of a hat. So you can definitely still get a job, but if you really want to get a season, you should apply in advance.
Yeah, for sure. Again, when we did natives, we definitely had that list of people ready to go, because things can change. As you say, when you've done seasons, you know what it's like. It's very dynamic. It may be that the member of staff isn't suitable. I either got sacked because I didn't get up in the morning, or it may be that they broke their leg and have to leave immediately and it's not going to be feasible for them to run a chalet anymore. Jenny?
What we do to combat people leaving during the season if for injuries and things is we actually recruit more staff actually through the summer. So we have a quota and then we employ additional staff, so they can go, UK staff can go out during the season and they can, they're in situ with their visa and their permit. Last year, the permits were taking 2 months through the winter. From November onwards, to get a permit issued took 2 months. But we were ahead of the game and we employed additional staff who were ready to go when a job became available. And also, we also speak to people about the potentially they can't start at the beginning of the season. Some people might not be available until January. So it means that they can't do the full season. And we would also speak to them and take those on in the summer as well, in preparation for being able to come out if the job comes up. So that's also something to bear in mind. Even if we're full, we still take additional staff.
That's really interesting. Again, if a listener is listening to this right now and they think, oh, I'd love to do a season, but I'm not going to be available till January because whatever commitment they've got, it's not all over. You can still do it. So that's really helpful, Jenny and George specifically. Yeah, thanks so much. Most of the jobs we've talked about here have been with British tour operators, but some people love the idea of working as a ski instructor. And we're lucky enough to have Dave with us today, who runs his own ski school, and you already mentioned some of the challenges of your recruitment. I wanted to kind of quiz you a little bit about the kind of qualifications that you need, because there are a lot of people who seem to sign up for ski instructor courses. There are a lot of them advertised all over the place. Some of them cost very large amounts of money, like £5,000 plus. So I wondered if we could kind of get a sense for what they are actually giving you. Maybe the qualifications on offer is a good place to start. You've kind of got BASI, CASI, NZSIA. Do you want to explain what those different things are and what they mean?
Yeah, so just to start off, I mean, to explain, I am a product of a GAP program. So a very, very long time ago now, I did Warren Smith Summer GAP in SASFE. I spent 8 weeks or 9 weeks, I think it was, on the glacier in SASFE, learning how to teach and learning how to ski properly. Of that course, I'm the only one that ever went on to do anything in the industry. So I'm one out of, I think it must have been 20. So in terms of your other question, each individual country normally has its own ski instructor association. And those associations then are sort of tasked with giving out qualifications and certifications. So, you know, for example, here in Europe, you know, you have Austria, Switzerland, Spain, I don't know whether Andorra has one, France certainly has one, Holland has one, you know, Denmark, you know, Norway, like it, and the same would apply for New Zealand, Australia, Japan, you know, Korea. So most countries have their own association. There are also associations. There's a new one just started recently called Professional Ski Instructors of Europe, which I'm a trainer for. And those guys are not attached to a particular country, but, you know, they also certify ski instructors, and we've been doing that the last winter as well.
Did not know that about you doing a Warren Smith course, which is really interesting. What qualification did you get as a result of that course then?
So with that course, I went and took it after about what we did about 1 week of sort of tidying up our skiing a little bit. Then we took the level one British, and so the Baisy level one. And then we did a whole bunch more training. And then the last 2 weeks of that course were the Baisy level two qualification. In between all of that, we did a whole bunch of work on our technical skiing. And to be fair, that sort of relentless drilling of movement pattern, it still serves me to this day. And then a whole bunch of kind of work on the teaching element. Not so much work about teaching, but certainly a lot of technical work, which has served me well. Yeah, that's for sure.
So that was a Baisy qualification. And we'll look at how that extends to working in Europe. But a lot of the instructor courses that are on offer are in Canada, and they give you a CSIA or a CASI qualification. Are those transferable? If you do a Canadian qualification, can you then bring that to Europe and work with that in Europe?
Yeah, so once you have it, you can. It is portable. So from a ski instructor, ski school director point of view, there is a body called the ISIA, Ski Instructor, International Ski Instructor Association. And what that does is it's sort of tasked with equalizing all of the levels. So most of the ski instructor systems, be it Canadian, be it American, be it, you know, Kiwi, be it whoever, have a four-level system. Some don't, you know, notably French, Swiss, and some others have a different way of doing it. But a lot of the Anglophone nations have this sort of four-level system. So that pretty much, you know, that if you've got a level two Canadian, for example, it is more or less equivalent to a British two or a New Zealand two or whatever. And so when I'm looking at a resume from someone who wants to come and work for us, you know, it gives me an indication of what level that person can ski and teach to. And that really helps me from that perspective, from a recruitment perspective.
Sure. And you're based in Switzerland, running a ski school in Switzerland. So can you bring anyone in? You have to go through presumably a bunch of visa hoops for that as well, do you?
Unfortunately, it used to be the case that we could kind of more or less employ whoever we wanted, including British people. But these days, everything comes down to passport. Certainly in Switzerland. So in Switzerland, we currently cannot employ British people. You have to have a really, really good reason to employ a British person. And ski instructor is not one of them. I've been into our local commune office and I've asked them multiple times. The priority for Swiss people or for a Swiss job is Switzerland, EU, and then the rest of the world. And you have to have a really good reason to employ a rest of the world person over and above EU people or native Swiss people.
And for France, my understanding is that that has a really, what would you call it, a high level of entry. Because, for example, if you want to, you can be a stagiaire on one of the lower levels of qualifications. But if you want to be a fully qualified instructor in France, you have to go through several hoops as well, which involve things like the test technique and the equivalence. Is that right?
You've done your research. This is great. So the French system is unique in a similar way to which the Italian system is unique. In the French system, in order just to get your foot in the door, you have to complete something called the test technique, which is a slalom timed run, and you've got to get within a certain percentage point of the openers of that course, and then you are then permitted entry into the training process, which I think takes about 5 years or something like that. And then at the end of their system, they have the dreaded Euro test. Euro test is also applicable in a bunch of other European countries. It's also applicable at the top of most systems, for certainly at the top of the British system, if you can get access to it. Well, that used to be the case, but now they've put in place a different speed test, which is called the ISIA speed test. We're getting into really into the weeds on this, but essentially, yes, the French system is much, much harder to get into and to complete. Eventually, they all end up at a roughly similar. So the highest level of anything is all roughly the same level. So I am qualified to Swiss Brevet Federal, which is the highest level you can get in Switzerland. I converted out of Bézier at some point and then went into the Swiss system. And all of the skiers at the top level, they ski the same. Doesn't matter what system you're in.
And in respect to, though, the test technique, which is a timed race, the Euro test, which is a timed race, it seems like a strange way of doing it. Like, my kids are taking driving lessons at the moment, and to become a driving instructor, you don't need to have done a lap of Brands Hatch in a certain time or anything like that. So what is the rationale behind that then?
There's two parts to this, I think. And one is that with something like the test technique and the Euro test, you learn a lot about yourself and you learn a lot about skiing in general. You can't get within anywhere near the time that you need to for the Euro test, for example, without really having a solid scale of ski fundamentals. However, the other way that you could look at it is just straightforward protectionism. So let's say that you grow up, like, let's say you're John Yves and you grow up in your little mountain village. Okay, your job opportunities are fairly limited, but you don't want to leave and go to the big city or something like that. You might be a carpenter or something in the summer, but in the winter, you go and work for the ESF, you guarantee yourself a really decent salary over the winter. You know, like, you can make decent money once you're fully qualified. The other part of that is, of course, is that you've grown up in the village, on the mountain, you've done ski club, right, about your whole life. And so for you, the Euro test is an easy thing to achieve. It's not a difficult thing because you've been doing it since you were 7 years old. And so if one wanted to limit the number of ski instructors that were coming through the system and you didn't want too much competition from outside, one could make an argument for having the Euro test in your system.
Yeah, I mean, that is brilliantly explained, Dave, actually. And, you know, when you do it like that, kind of think, well, yes. I mean, we all understand about mountain communities and the fact that they're dependent on their ski seasons, because often nothing else happens for the other kind of 7 months of the year. So that's really interesting. Let me ask another question then, as you're our instructor representative. A lot of people, this is their idealized job, being a ski instructor. But I sense that maybe those people have never been an instructor, because while, it, you know, you do get to go to the front of the queue the whole time and you're regarded very highly, it's hard work, right? Teaching people how to ski on a day-to-day basis when you have to go out, whatever the weather is. I mean, we all see those instructors in those really big coats, so that you've got one of those really long coats for when it's pissing, watch my language, for when it's raining really heavily, but you still got to out and do your job. There's no, you know, you can't be a fair weather skier if you're an instructor, can you?
The only way that you can be a fair weather skier when you're an instructor is to be the boss like me. And then what happens is, if you don't like the look of the weather, you just ring up your client and say, hey, the mountain's telling us not to do it today. Let's do it on a different day. But my instructors don't have that luxury. So, yeah, you're right. Everyone has to have the big coat. You go out in all days, all weathers. It is not glamorous in the way that you think it is. Like, it's, you actually have got to be in it for the right reasons. And most of us who stay within it are in it because we love to teach. We're not in it just because we want, you know, it's that meme, isn't it? It's like, you know, what everyone thinks I do is just skiing powder, but actually what I do is I'm skiing backwards on the beginner slope most of the time, because that's where we do our work. Yeah, occasionally you get good lessons, but you have to climb the pyramid quite a long way to get the decent lessons. You know, you have to be really well qualified, that you cannot give out higher level intermediate lessons to say level one or level two instructors, right? Like, you know, people have to know their stuff.
And that is really interesting. And, you know, it's brilliant having you on the show again, Dave. Love your snow reports. And, you know, if anyone listening wants to go deeper into the world of ski instructors, Dave presents his own podcast called the Ski Instructor Podcast, of which there's many, many deep dive episodes with instructors from around the world. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Right. Hopefully, listener, you found that interesting. Massive topic. So many different things to cover. But we're going to move to the close now. I enjoy finding out from listeners what you think of the show. Always interested to hear from you. So please do contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. We've had a bit of feedback since our last episode. Robbie Milne on Spotify said, great recent episodes, keeping the stoke well and truly alive. I'm getting married this summer, meaning I couldn't go out for spring skiing, but this podcast makes it not so bad. I was delighted to hear, Robbie. Steve from York said, I love the variety of topics covered in the podcast. Gets you revved up for your next trip to the mountains. On Apple Podcast, Paul 1608 said, I've recently found the podcast and I'm working my way through the back catalogue. I can't make it to the mountains this year, but the podcast is the next best thing. And Rob Olive said, I've enjoyed listening to Ski Podcast since lockdown, when it helped me keep going during those dark days. I recently found the episode on taking an EV to the Alps particularly useful. We drove to Le Menuire in an EV in February, and Ian's advice and tips helped smooth the journey and calm the nerves about charging in France. Keep up the great work. So thanks for that, Rob. I'm going to do one more shout out to Norse K Sarah on Apple Podcasts. Sarah, you won the Vallon Sunnies in our competition. I announced it in our last episode. But you need to send me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com with your address to claim them. So look forward to hearing from you, Sarah. Right. There are now 258 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and 127 of those were listened to in the last week. If you enjoyed the episode, why not do what Paul did above? Go to theskipodcast.com and have a look around. There are loads of really interesting topics in there to keep your snow fix going over the summer. Now, if you like the Ski Podcast, normally I'd ask you to give us a review or to follow us. But this week, all I'm going to ask is that you consider sponsoring my 25 for 25 snow camp challenge. The link is in the show notes. Any amount, no matter how small, will make a difference. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. You can follow us on WhatsApp as well for exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. I'd like to thank my guest today. Jenny, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent. George, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian. Yeah, had a great time.
And Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and I wish you and all your listeners a lovely summer.
Thank you. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.